Good morning. It is good to see you all. If you will, take out your Bibles and turn over to Mark chapter 9. Mark chapter 9. We have a lengthy reading here, and I really wanted to get through verses 14 through 29 this morning, but it was going to take an hour, probably just a little bit more, so you're welcome. We're just going to kind of lay a foundation this morning in regard to what is stated at the beginning. And so it's one of those difficulties, you might say, in reading the text beforehand and taking that time. I really believe that it's necessary. I'm going to read through it pretty quickly as I can, you might say, so that you get the gist, because we're not going to cover all of the story of this demon-possessed son. But the whole story will be taken into consideration this morning as we at least have an introduction to what happens and how Jesus intervenes on behalf of this father and his son. Now, take into consideration that Jesus and his three closest apostles, ones that were at his transfiguration that we just looked at this last Sunday, they saw Jairus' daughter raised, and then the third obviously would be at his baptism. Fourth, that really stands out, but then again, the baptism, that should have been all of them. So the last, of course, is going into the Garden of Gethsemane. So those would be the three that they're really isolated, you might say. And so we have considered that Peter, James, and John are with Jesus, and they're coming down from the Mount of Transfiguration. This was an extraordinary event that oftentimes we just read through and we don't really take into consideration the full gravity of that moment. But we talked about that last week, so we won't rehash it. Starting in verse 14 of Mark chapter 9. And when he came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them and scribes disputing with them. Immediately when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed and running to him, greeted him. And he asked the scribes, "What are you discussing with them?" Then one of the multitude answered and said, "Teacher, I brought you my son, who has a mute spirit. And whenever he seizes him," that is the mute spirit seizes him, "he throws him down, he foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast him out, but they could not." He answered him and said, "O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me." That's how far we're going to get this morning. But so we have the full context. Then they brought him to him. And when he saw him, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed foaming at the mouth. So he asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And often he," that is this evil spirit, "has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything..." I have a hard time reading my Bible right here because I wrote in ink on the other side, and it's really hard for me. "If you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." Then Jesus saw that the people came running together, and he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to him, "You deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him no more." Then the spirit cried out, convulsed him greatly, and came out of him, and he became as one dead, so that many said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had come into the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast him out?" So he said to them, "This kind can come out by nothing but prayer and fasting." And so I've titled this lesson, "Help My Unbelief." And like I said, it will be part one. It may be part one of three. It may be part one of two. We will just see how things unfold. But the story of this demon-possessed son is about three things. That is faith, authority, and ultimately prayer. Most of the time, faith is emphasized when it comes to this story. The faithlessness of the apostles and the somewhat faith of the Father and all the faith of Jesus Christ. But I think that it goes deeper than that, and it's about authority. And we'll address that as we go through this lesson, and also about prayer, because that's where Jesus ends up. You know, why couldn't we cast out this spirit? And he says you can only do it through prayer. And so soon, Jesus is going to be dead. Jesus is going to be resurrected. Jesus is going to show himself to the apostles, but then Jesus is going to ascend to the Father, and he is not going to be with them much longer. As we've already noted, he's got about 3 more months to live on this earth. So time is short. Time is coming to an end, and it's really crucial. And he is still having to deal with their, in his own words, faithlessness. That is huge for him. The apostles aren't going to have him present. This seems to be putting a lot of stress on Jesus because time is short and he's getting frustrated. And I wonder if God gets a little frustrated with our faithlessness from time to time. I wonder how patient God is with us. And is it possible that we haven't achieved the kind of faith that we ought to have? And he's still patient and still, you know, trying to get us to come along, if you will. Now we know in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Drop down to verse 6, but without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7, we walk by faith and not by sight. We're at a great disadvantage in comparison to the apostles who were eyewitnesses of Jesus Christ. That's how 1 John starts off. They saw things that we will never have opportunity to see. As we mentioned before, the transfiguration, going into the garden, seeing Jesus ascend into the heavens, all the miracles. Miracle after miracle. And they were still faithless. So if our faith is tested from time to time, duh. Of course. That doesn't mean we should waver. But it's understandable that we may have doubts from time to time. Ultimately, there is a spiritual conflict always in our lives. The apostles needed to learn on this occasion faith over power and prayer over authority. Faith over power and prayer over authority. So faith over authority and prayer over authority might be another way to put it. The apostles have had possibly the same idea that these televangelists. Maybe if you watched any kind of sermons online or on TV, you might have heard some of the prosperity preaching. Name it and claim it, right? It's the concept that all you got to do is if you want the Cadillac, Just tell God, I want a Cadillac. And since you've named it, as long as you believe it's going to happen, guess what's going to happen? I mean, that's my religion. I don't know about y'all, but I'm in the wrong place. Because there's a few things I would like to name it and claim it. You with me? I wonder if that was the mentality of the apostles. Because we can't forget that they have already cast out many demons. They've already performed these miracles. Notice in Mark chapter 6 and verse 13, and they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and healed them. And so did they get the idea that all they have to do is name it and claim it? That mentality that all I got to do is say the magic words. Done. Uh-oh. Didn't work this time. What's wrong? How much opposition in our lives do we have to have before we have that seed of doubt? Abracadabra. He's still foaming at the mouth. Abracadabra. He's still convulsing. Abracadabra. It's not working. Oh no. Let's turn over to Ephesians chapter 6 in verse 18. Ephesians 6 in verse 18, you are very familiar with, beginning in verse 10. Be strong in the Lord and the power of His might. Because we're up against these entities, these powers, these authorities. In verse 12, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places, put on the whole armor of God. And finally, he ends in verse 18. If we even read it, we've got to read it. This kind of seals the deal, you might say. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit. And you've already heard me make a distinction between prayer and supplication. Prayer can include everything, thanksgiving and supplication, but supplication is really just pouring your heart out to God. You have desperate need of Him. And in this context, it's because you are fighting against a foe. It's insurmountable. The only way we're going to overcome is if we put on all this armor that God has issued, right? The helmet of salvation, breastplate of righteousness, shod our feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. We gird our waist with the, you know, a belt of truth, a shield of faith, the sword of the Spirit. We're ready to fight, but we better put prayer in it. We better put God in it. That's the context. Oh boy, we've got a battle ahead of us. Turn over to James chapter 4. The problem is that our prayers may not have the kind of spirit that they should. James chapter 4, notice in verses 2 and 3, you lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight in war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. And so it sounds like all you got to do is just ask and God's going to give it to you. No, keep on reading. Verse 3, you ask and do not receive because you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures. We're praying for the wrong things. Is it possible that the apostles, the other nine, remember this isn't Peter, James, and John, they say the words, but they're not really looking for God, or not looking to God for the true authority, the real power to cast out this evil spirit out of this son. So I'm going to go through a little equation here. Please pay attention. It won't be on the overhead. Ultimately, I can't do it. And you can say that. I'm not asking you to repeat after me, but I can't do it. We would all say that. That's the humility. God can do it. That's faith. Appropriating His power is when we pray. When we acknowledge He is the true one that has the power and the authority And so the father of the boy asked for help, but it would seem the apostles did not. You get the point? The father went and asked the apostles. Now that's going to become really crucial in our third point. Just kind of lock that in the back of your mind. He goes to the apostles, the nine, to have his son exorcised, to have this spirit cast out. The fault of the apostles may be that they didn't really seek God for the power to do so, and they failed. Now, do we do that sometimes? Do we really not look to God in faith and pray earnestly, pray with supplication, continue in prayer, really looking to God for the wisdom, for the strength, the vitality to get through whatever it is that we would be obviously praying about? So, the closer you are to God, the easier that's going to be. Keep in mind, where's Jesus when this happens? When the nine apostles aren't able to cast out this evil spirit? Jesus is up on the mountain. They're down in the valley. Jesus isn't there. But He wasn't there when they were sent out two by two and they had cast out demons already. But something's lost along the way, because the spirit, the evil spirit, can be cast out. Jesus acknowledges that can happen, but only by prayer. And so it would seem to me that they're leaving God out of the equation, and now they're going to kind of take care of things themselves. You remember that in Acts, I don't remember exactly where it is, but you know, the guy, he's heard or he's seen, you know, Paul cast out, and he says, "I cast you out by the God of Paul," and so on, you know, and Jesus Christ. And the Spirit replies, "Well, I know who Jesus is, and I know who Paul is, but I don't know who you are." And he comes out and, you know, grabs a hold of him. The guy runs out naked and so on. I mean, you can just use the Bible. You don't need Hollywood to you know, get the laughter or the sarcasm or the drama or Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9 and verse 41. Boy, my time is getting away. Luke 9 and 41. This is the same occurrence, just Luke's account. "Then Jesus answered and said, O faithless and perverse generation." Oh, you talk about a stab, a punch in the gut, a slap in the face. Verse 40, "I implored your disciples to cast it out, this evil spirit, but they could not." And Jesus' response, and I don't think he's talking, he could be talking to the man, but he's really referencing his apostles. "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." Who else is going to be able to cast out this evil spirit? It's not just Joe Schmo, Uncle Tom, Aunt Betty. Who's it going to be? Jesus or his apostles? At this point in time, he cannot be talking to anyone else. Are we, from time to time, that faithless, perverse generation, because we're not seeking the authority? We're not seeking God in faith, and we're certainly not seeking Him in prayer like we ought. There's many allegories. I'm going to bypass those few points that I would have here and jump to the second point. For time's sake, we can definitely deal with it next week. The apostles are struggling with their faith. So we have from glory. And I say apostles, remember I'm talking about the nine specifically because Peter, James, and John have been up on the mountain with Jesus. So from Jesus' perspective, from glory on the mountain to faithless apostles below. Like Moses in the presence of God on Mount Sinai, being sent down to the valley to the unbelieving children below. Remember, Jesus had gone to Nazareth in Mark chapter 6 and verse 6, and he says, I quote, "And he marveled because of their unbelief." In Mark chapter 6 and verse 52, "For they had not understood about the loaves," this is his apostles, "because their heart was hardened." Now, these are people who are in the presence of Jesus Christ. They're in the presence of God Himself. They're seeing these miracles. We're talking about all kinds of miracles. We're talking about walking on water, the power over nature. We're talking about power over illness, power over death, which is the strongest thing that Satan has in his arsenal. Power over the spiritual world to cast out evil spirits. They've seen it all. They're still struggling. What about you and me? 2 Corinthians 5:7, "We walk by faith and not by sight." What an overstatement. The end of John. "Many signs and wonders Jesus did that are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe." Remember, Luke 16, I get those mixed up. But anyways, the story of the rich man and Lazarus. Remember, and the rich man wants Abraham to send Lazarus back from the dead? Because if Lazarus comes back from the dead, they'll believe. And Abraham says, no, they won't. Even if one were to rise from the dead, they won't believe. They have Moses and the prophets. You know, that's all we got too. Well, not all. I mean, you know, we have the New Testament. But I mean, we that's all. Faith. Faith. That's all we have. There's evidence. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Hebrews 11:1 we quoted a while ago. But we have to walk by faith. These people are struggling. We're not done. Mark 7:18. "And he said to them, are you thus without understanding also? Do you not perceive? Are you blind? Are you deaf? Can't you see and hear what's going on around you?" I mean, you can just... The frustration of Jesus, it excretes from him. Mark 8:17-18, and then we'll jump over to verse 21. "But Jesus, being aware of it, said to them," this is the apostles, "why do you reason because you have no bread?" You remember studying that? "Do you not perceive nor understand?" He's saying, what's wrong with you? Is your heart still hardened? That's a difficult accusation right there. Is your heart still hardened? "Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember?" Jumping down to verse 21. "So he said to them, how is it you do not understand?" He's pulling his hair out. He's banging his head against the wall. He ain't got much time left. And in our context, he's got about 3 months. Come on, kid. Your test is Monday. You better get this through your thick skull. It's Friday. And that's what we are sometimes. And so I want to shift gears and want you to consider this in a little bit different light. From Jesus' perspective, think about how this would make Jesus feel. He's coming down from glory, coming down to a faithless generation, but a faithless group of men that He has coddled, that He has coaxed, that He has babied, that He has tried to bring along, He's been patient with for 3 years. Mark 9, verse 14, and when He had came to His disciples, He saw a great multitude around Him. The scribes disputing with them. Immediately when they saw Him, all the people were greatly amazed and running to Him, greeted Him. And He asked the scribes, "What are you discussing with them?" Now, I don't know what Jesus knew beforehand and so on. I didn't know whether He knew the next step He was going to take. I don't know if He knew the heart of the person standing there. He has every right or every power or whatever I don't know. I don't know if He just knows all the hearts of everyone around Him simultaneously, or if He chooses not to. And so does He know? I don't know. Is it really a legit question to say, "Hey, what are you saying to my disciples?" But that's what He does say. "What are you discussing with them?" The scribes are the copy machines of the day. They thought that they were smarter than the actual author of the books. And I say books because of which they made the copies. You get the irony, right? How they questioned Jesus. They questioned the author, the guy who wrote the book. They're questioning whether He's really right or wrong. The creator of the universe, right? Wow! The scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the elders, the religious leaders as a whole were constantly trying to question, discredit, smear, dishonor, find fault, etc., etc., in Jesus. They were threatened by Jesus and constantly on guard to protect their standing among the people, their reputation, their rule, frankly, their authority over the people. They knew they were losing their influence, their followers to Jesus, and they despised Him. Don't think for a second that this argument, this disputing that's going on between them is with good intentions by these scribes. So Jesus says, of what were the scribes and apostles arguing? Mark chapter 3, verses 20 through 22. Mark 3, 20 through 22. "Then the multitude came together again so that they could not so much as eat bread," just putting it in context, "but when His own people heard about it, they went out to lay hold of Him," that is Jesus, we think it might be His family, His immediate family, "and they said, 'He's out of His mind.'" So even His own people, whatever that was, if that's His mama and His brothers and sisters, they, in essence, we've already studied this, they show up and say, "He's out of His mind. Come on, Jesus, you got to go with us. You got to get some respite. You're killing yourself. You're working too hard." So that's His own people. Then notice in verse 22, "And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem said, 'He has Beelzebub, and by the ruler of the demons He casts out demons.'" Now you talk about a low blow. So think about it. Jesus is up on the mountain. He's completely changed. He's shining as bright as any light could possibly be. His garments are made like no launderer can make on the face of the earth. God speaks from heaven, says, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Hear Him." What was Moses, Elijah, and Jesus discussing? His demise. You got to do it. You got to do it, Jesus. Everything we have said from God, from you, points to you and what's going to happen in a few months. And then He comes down, having already been accused that He's casting out demons by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons. And guess what? His own apostles, these nine men who have been with Him for over 3 years, cannot cast out this evil spirit. When you send someone on a job, let's say you own a business, it doesn't matter what business it is, and you believe that they can take care of it, and you send them out to the customer, and they do not perform. In fact, they may make it worse. And you get the phone call. You get someone showing up at your office. You sent someone out here to do a job, and they've made it worse, or they couldn't do their job. We call it eating crow. That's what Jesus comes down to. All glory. Down to a faithless, and as Luke puts it, perverse generation. Because they could not cast out this evil spirit. What does that say about Jesus? Just like what would that say about your company when the worker can't do his job? Humiliating. Discrediting. We said not too long ago He was casting out demons by Beelzebub, but now it's His apostles. See, He's just doing it just to show that He can do something, but He's really doing it by the ruler of the demons. And Jesus, of course, Jesus' argument is that that's the stupidest thing I ever heard in my life. You can't divide a house and it still stand. But now His apostles, nine of them, can't cast out this evil spirit. Terrible. I think that it's gotten me in trouble in times past and still to this day. But I was told by Billy Moore two things. Didn't learn a lot from Billy. Rest in peace. There's one thing that I don't know if it's been good or it's been detrimental. I think between God and myself, it's been wonderful. Between the brethren and me, it's been a trial. Let me share those two things. In all your preaching and teaching, you got to ask yourself, are you really, the audience has every right to question you. Two things. The first really is just to make a statement. So what? And he would say it in that kind of attitude, you know, that with that kind of inflection, that attitude. So what? And the second is, what does that have to do with me? And that's how I always approach any study. Not with a bad attitude towards God, you know, so what? But that idea is that, okay, what does that mean to me, ultimately? Brethren, when we show faithlessness in God, in whatever situation we're in, whatever circumstance we find ourselves, if we don't seek Him in His true authority by prayer in complete faith to His glory and honor, we, along with those nine apostles, are a faithless and perverse generation. Now we can put on our pride and call it humility, like I mentioned in the thoughts of the Lord's Supper, all day long. We can pride ourselves in our humility. The apostles tried and they failed miserably because they couldn't cast out that spirit. They could have, but something was awry. I don't know what it was because the scriptures don't tell us, but something. My point is that it brought humiliation on Jesus. It represented the power of Jesus. And in fact, we'll see next week, Lord willing, if you'll notice, what does this guy say? It really stands out in verse 22. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But what? But what? You should have your sword out and looking at it right now. But what? But if you can do anything. You see, when we show faithlessness towards our God, what kind of God do we serve? Do we serve an all-powerful God or not? Not if we show our faithlessness over here. Not if we don't have the right confidence in God. Not if we can walk in the Spirit and not in the flesh. Not if we can face our foe, put on all this armor, and we're ready to fight. Not if we can't turn to book, chapter, and verse. Here's the authority. Here's why I say what I say. Here's what I believe. And we give ourselves in continual prayer. Never wavering. Poor Jesus. Makes me want to cry. Poor Jesus. Because I haven't always been the person I ought to be. While this world exists, a spiritual war rages on. Like the apostles, and more so, there will always be times when our faith is tested. Ultimately, we need to possess great faith and act like it because we claim to be Christians and disciples of Jesus Christ. And we're representing Him. I'm not saying we're ambassadors in the same sense of the apostles and so on. I understand. We can't be faithless. But boy, are we going to be tried. So if you have struggles believing in miracles, that's the whole point of a miracle. It's unbelievable. But you got to believe it. Hard for you to believe that Jesus Christ came in the flesh? Well, you gotta. Do you believe that Jesus Christ died upon the cross? You gotta believe it. Here's the evidence. Eyewitness testimonies. Do you believe that He was resurrected from the dead? You better. Is it hard to believe? For some, it's really, really hard. And I don't blame them, because I ain't ever seen anyone raised from the dead. How about you? Do you believe that in the waters of baptism you access that death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ? That your sins are washed away, that you rise in newness of life? Well, you better. You gonna live faithful to your dying day? Revelation 2:10 is our go-to. You better. We're gonna sin willfully after we've received so great a salvation? You better stop. Because we claim to be Christians, we claim to be disciples of Jesus Christ, we must live it. Because there's a world around us that's going to mock not only us, but our God, who is true, who is absolutely faithful when we are not. Because He is, and He can't deny Himself. Where do we stand? May we stand with God and be more faithful as the days go by, and that is to let Him rule our lives. He has the authority. Colossians 3:17, and we're going to stay in constant prayer, always seeking His strength along the way. If we can help you surrender or to come back to the Lord, won't you come as we stand and sing?